Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, Edwige Dantakot. Dantakot was born in Haiti, and her early education was in French and Creole. She joined her parents in Brooklyn when she was 12, and only then began to learn English. Although her new neighborhood was familiar, it was largely Haitian-American, she wasn't comfortable there, and she turned to writing for solace. She was first published in New Youth Connection, a publication for New York teens at the age of 14. Her story was in English, a remarkable feat for someone who had only been speaking the language for just 2 years. Writing about her immigration experience played heavily in Dantakot's juvenile work and was the raw material for her celebrated first novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory, which was published in 1994. Since then, she's won a number of awards, including the 1999 American Book Award for The Farming of Bones. Dantakot has been nominated for the National Book Award twice, for her 1996 collection of short stories, Crick Crack, and her 2007 memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. The latter earned her a National Book Critics Circle Award, and in 2009 she was the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Here's Edwige Dantakot speaking in 2010 at Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you, Portland, Oregon. Happy Earth Day. I understand you're the greenest city in America. Green and readers. My God, this must be heaven. Thank you, Andrew and Susan. And all of you for coming here tonight, and thank you to the folks at Mercy Corps for what they're doing in Haiti and what they're doing all over the world. And thank you for, by being here, you're also contributing to their cause. So thank you very much. And the countryside in Haiti, where my family's from, when we first meet people, we say "oné," and the response to that is respect. "Oné" meaning honor, and respect meaning respect. So I am honored and respectful, and I would ask you to do it with me. We'll pretend we're in the countryside in Haiti. "Oné," respect. Thank you. I want to talk to you tonight a little bit about Haiti after the earthquake. And when I tried to put together a title to what I wanted to say, this is what Haiti after the earthquake, nous songer, nous avancer, remembering as we move forward. I was a couple of weeks ago at a mass in Little Haiti where I live. And the priest, and this is what the priest kept saying, nous songer, mais nous avancer, remembering as we move forward. So I want to begin my remembering by telling you a story. And it's a story that I try to tell in Brother, I'm Dying. And it's a story about God and the angel of death. And often in Haiti also, when we have tragedies, and milder tragedies than what we recently had, but when we have tragedies, I try, as a sense of meaning, to look for some meaning in the stories that I was told when I was little. And the story of Papa God and the angel of death was one that keeps coming back to me at different moments in the tragedy. And the story goes that Papa, the angel and death, and God were just hanging out one day. I don't know if there was a bar, if there was a rabbi around. But they were hanging out, and they got all competitive. And God says to the angel of death, well, you know, the people on earth, they love me more than they love you. And the angel of death said, no, they love me more than they love you. And then they said, well, let's put this theory to the test. So we'll go to, and you fill in the neighborhood where you're from. In my case, it's Bel Air, in Haiti. So we'll go to Bel Air and test this. So they both of them go to the a woman's house. They knock on the door, and they ask the woman for some water. And God goes first and says, "Madame, can I have some water?" And the woman says, "The only person I would give my water right now to is the angel of death." And so, and then the angel of death comes, and then the woman gives the water. And then God, of course, goes to the woman and says, "Well, why would you give the angel of death water and not me?" And the woman says, "Well, because ukon bay to God, ukon bay mo bakon separe. You know how to give, but you don't know how to share equally to everyone. But the angel of death is more democratic. Everybody goes." And so this woman found the secret. And when I went to Haiti after the earthquake, this is one thing, one of the things, we have a lot of proverbs in Creole. It's one of the things that people kept saying, you know, nous tout jouen. This time everybody got some. And the sense that it was shared equally, whether you were rich, whether you were poor. So reinforcing the angel of death, nous tout jouen. And I also, moi t'es jouen, I also shared in that because my cousin Maxo died during the earthquake. The house that I visit, we used to visit at this point when I would go to Haiti, collapsed on top of him. Maxo was one of the people who was featured in my last book, Brother, I'm Dying, because he traveled with my uncle, his father, who was 81 when he left Haiti in 2004 after a gang threatened his life. So Maxo and my uncle were together, and they traveled to Miami after this incident in the neighborhood, and they asked to be granted asylum. And instead, they were detained by the Department of Homeland Security, and they were separated while they were in custody. And when Maxo was finally able to see my uncle, it was to translate for him because he had become ill, and my uncle was vomiting at this hearing for the asylum. He was accused of faking his illness. And the next day, my uncle died, and Maxo was released from detention to bury his father. And Maxo he stayed here in the United States a while and tried to pursue this case for asylum, but it was stalling, and every time he would go to court, the lawyer would say, you know, just bring all your things because you don't know if they could arrest you after the hearing. So he was just tired of this tension. And he had five young kids in Haiti. So finally, he decided to go back to Haiti. But in Maxo's, and when the house collapsed on top of Maxo that afternoon of the earthquake, when it collapsed, when houses collapsed on so many people, there were immediately, of course, lessons that now with some distance that we are learning from this. One of the things that we learned gradually after this happened was that how much kindness people displayed, and this was repeated throughout all of Haiti after the earthquake. People who didn't have, who sometimes had a, you know, just a pick or just house instruments, really were digging each other out. And this is how Maxo's four of his children, one died with him, but four of his children and his wife were rescued under the rubble 2 days later because people kept digging before the world came in with their bare hands. And this is what really was a big lesson for even those of us who know Haiti, this capacity for people to unite. The motto of Haiti is, in unity, there's strength. L'union fait la force. And it's one thing that people sometimes think Haiti has, we have so little in terms of money that we don't have much to teach the world. But I always said when I first went back to people to Haiti, I felt like I was saying to people, you were teaching the world a lot with the little you had. And the way that people helped each other. Tout moun jouen, everybody got some, but also everybody shared what they were able to. So I was thinking a lot about Maxo and all my family in Haiti when some people in the media would call to ask for reaction. And at first there is that feeling when you're involved in a personal tear, you're trying to find your family. And I had offers, for example, people would say, "Oh, we'll go, we'll take you, we'll film you, going to find your family." But and I would have done, except I had a little baby, and I, you know, and I would offer other family members. I would say, take this uncle, but it didn't. They didn't take bite. But I was thinking about these particular faces when I was asked that. And when you go, you know, try to express with a singular voice the feeling of so many people, of something so big, of course you were numb. And that's really what I wanted to say, that I was numb, because every moment you were thinking, oh, I haven't heard from so-and-so. And even now to this day, you know, we are finding out new people who have died. You know, you would run into someone and they said, oh, you know, I lost my brother, I lost. And this is a kind of reoccurring all the time. But once I got, you know, once you do go on the programs, there were certain things like these lessons that I felt like I wanted to tell people, and things that we say to each other, I guess, as Haitians in the midst of other tragedies. I wanted to say, for example, we say, you know, we always say that Haiti is terre glissée, slippery ground. And even the word Haiti means mountainous land. And you combine mountainous land with slippery ground, it's not a steady place. And when we say terre glissée, we mean it physically, you know, geographically, but we also mean politically, so that you can have stability a moment and another. But all of a sudden, it felt like our hearts were slippery ground. Like we didn't know what to do with ourselves. And it remains so now. And one of the first things when you go and people are sleeping outside and they're, you know, they call them tent cities, but a lot of places it's sheet cities, you know, people with sheets under them, and it's scorching hot in the daytime, and it's, you know, it's just, it's cold at night, or it's raining, and people have to stand up when it's raining because the water's going under, and sometimes people are standing up with little babies in their arms, and sometimes they're, you know, they'll close off a street, and people are sleeping out in the open. And in the Haitian lore, there's just so many sort of scary stories about the night, that it's just a whole transformation of who we are, that so much of life happens in the open. You know, things like you would see if you go to the countryside, people bathing in the river in a kind of pastoral way. But now it's like a major city street, people are bathing, which brings, you know, just all kinds of risk to women and all, you know, just this whole life. It's sort of like the whole staging part of, like, everything is out in the open. So this is the new slippery ground, because when people were, before it started raining, the, you know, rainy season starts May 1st, hurricane season starts June 1st, slippery ground. Imagine where before you would have a simple rain and there would be mudslides. So that was one of the sort of the increasing fears. And people used to say in Haiti, you know, they used to say, we want to go from misery to poverty. And now it's sort of, we're going from this deep, agonizing misery. And can you imagine where we have gotten to a point where poverty is now, you know, a lesser poverty is a kind of dreams. So I wanted to say all of that. And I tried to say, but I also wanted to say that love, like sort of our love for Haiti, like the, you know, when I hadn't gone yet to Haiti, I felt like I kept envisioning it as a kind of, like a globe, you know, that I wanted to just go and wrap my arms around. And I kept meeting so many people like that. And it was just the thing for me, not so much for the place or the, but for me to just have that feeling. So our love is deeper on some level, but the place itself has changed. It's changed physically, the landscape, and you know, these mountains that had been stripped bare of their trees because of erosion, and, you know, and the city. A city that was meant to hold 200,000 people, now with 3 million people in it. So slippery ground indeed. And this was a natural disaster, of course, but it was one that was in the making for such a long time because of these agricultural policies that eliminated local growing. So people were coming off their lands into the capital. So if you had Tropical Storm Jeanne, for example, in 2004, which happened right before Katrina, had covered an entire city. And you had little rains, as I said, just causing mudslides. So this city had really no chance against this earthquake. So I tried to say all this whenever I went on the radio and in television. And maybe it started making me think about sort of our purposes, I guess, as immigrants, people who, even if you are not an author, if you're a regular person from Haiti or Chile or Darfur, and what is it that you do as a representative in your own limited way of a kind of things? What you do is that if you're a writer or a kind of artist, you're sort of gathering these voices and you're trying to replay them for both the distant and the local devastation. Because they were, for example, in Miami, where I am, kids who were showing up for school a day after the day of the earthquake, just passing out because they hadn't heard from their relatives. So we had all of that in a way as part of our remembering as we tried to advance, as we tried to move forward. After 9/11, the Palestinian American poet Soher Ahmad, she was in Deaf Comedy Poetry. One of the tall, beautiful women and that. And she had written a short poem, and one line, and she says, "There's no poetry in the ashes of Canal Street." And because this is what I have, a sort of my consolation, this is what the thing I do, so I kept wondering, would there be poetry amidst the Haitian ruins? And it was too soon. For me, it was very, aside from the things that I was trying to bring out of myself, it was very too soon to write, because there's also this feeling, as someone who lives outside of the country, you feel like you were not there, you did not live it, you don't have a right to speak. So then I started reading, and you would read hundreds of these narratives, and then occasionally would come across the story of someone you hadn't heard of, but someone that you knew. And one of these people was a woman named Dolores Dominique Neptune, whose father was one of Haiti's most famous radio journalists, Jean-Dominique. And he is featured in a documentary that was directed by Jonathan Demme called The Agronomist. And I know her sisters better, but I knew of her family, and suddenly this flashes across the screen. And the person who forwards it writes, it's a casual email, but it takes on this epic tone. The person writes, "Here is the tale of the death of Jean-Olivier Neptune, written by his mother." And this is all email. It's not literature. It's not pretense. It's just someone pouring out their loss. And she writes, "Where is my son? The house collapsed on top of him. He is in his room on his bed. I call his name. I call on God and negotiate with him. I call on the neighbors." What neighbors? "All the houses have collapsed and no one will come." And later the neighbors do come and they organize a massive effort and they really literally emerge out of the rubble and they find her son. And he's lying on his bed just as though he were napping. And she writes, "What an angel. His left hand is resting on his stomach as he lies in his bed. My son is dead." And a few days later, I read my friend, the novelist Evelyne Tuyo, who I had interviewed. She lives in Haiti. I'd interviewed her a few years ago in Bomb magazine, and we had a wonderful conversation right after Gonaïve was covered in water from Tropical Storm Jeanne. And so she wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times on January 21st, a week or so after the earthquake. And she wrote, "The family has set up camp in my brother's house. I live just next door, but it makes us feel better to be all in the same house. My brother, a novelist, is writing his articles. I am writing mine." And some of you might have seen 3 months after they had her write another op-ed, and she wrote about going to the sea. And for a lot of people, it's odd to people sometimes that we Haitians, we are on an island, but a lot of us don't swim. And so the sea can be both menacing, and there's a lot of myth and lore about the sea, the goddess of the sea. It's a seductive Simbina Dlo. There's like wonderful songs about the sea. And she writes about just putting your water, just trusting nature again, which is extraordinary after the earthquake, because we've had people come to our house in Miami after, and if they're eating with you and you just tap the table, they get up. because they're just movement. They just don't trust movement. So this, her piece about just trusting nature again, I found incredible. And her brother, Lionel Touyo, who is one of our most wonderful Haitian novelist who lives in Haiti, and he has books that have been translated here. One of them is a book called Streets of Lost Footsteps, Rue des Pas Perdus. And Lionel was posting on Le Point, a daily blog, and on day 5 he wrote, I heard the drums from a Vodou ceremony. I didn't have enough energy to go and find out if they were praising or rebuking the gods. I started heading there anyway, but came across a group of people who were playing dominoes by moonlight. I listened to the jokes being told by the players about both the living and the dead. I know that like them, at the end of the day, I need to laugh. And I needed to laugh too. So I read Danny Laferrière. And Danny Laferrière, and this is also kind of a shorthand course in Haitian literature, if you haven't noticed. And Danny Laferrière is one of our sort of Haitian-Canadian star writers. And his first novel, it'll give you a sense of his humor. His first novel was called Comment faire l'amour avec un nègre sans se fatiguer? How to make love to a Negro without getting tired. It's okay because he is a Negro. So I needed to laugh. I said, if anybody can make me laugh, it is Danny. And he's really one of the funniest writers we have. And he was one of the organizers in a literary festival that was supposed to happen in Haiti 2 days after the earthquake. And he was there doing it. And after the earthquake happened, you know, he left Haiti and went back. And again, this thing of what is your role as sort of writer, witness, artist, and people, when he went back to Canada, a few people criticized him for returning to Canada. And they, you know, saying like he should have stayed with his people. And my sense of it was that he would have stayed with his people if he were a doctor or someone, but his job at that point was in a way to bear witness, which is what we all, in sort of the helplessness as people with voices who write and do these things, and the helplessness is what we felt like we could do. And this thing that he was facing, I felt for me, was sort of the dilemma of the immigrant artist, the artist immigrant. What is your role at this particular moment of tragedy and the place where you come from?
You're listening to Edwidge Dantakot, and this is the Archive Project from Literary Arts. More with Dantakot is coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. It's Edwidge Dantakot this time.
And so Danny had written this book. I went to the last book that he wrote. It was a book called L'Énigme du Retour, The Enigma of Return. And if you can see that, it echoes Naipaul, the Enigma of Arrival. And the book was about this novelist. He often writes sort of the alter ego novelist. And it was the novelist who returns to Haiti after the death of his father. And the whole book is sort of this journey through all these sites in Haiti. And it was just all of a sudden, this book that was written last year suddenly was like a historical novel. And then it struck me, and as I think it strikes many people at different times, that of course there will always be now the Haiti of before the earthquake and the Haiti of after the earthquake. Just as people were saying, you know, after September 11, I mean, it's not fair to compare tragedies. It's his own tragedy. But it's kind of the same feeling that there will be, you know, there will be the U.S. before September 11, the U.S. after September 11, and there's the Haiti before the earthquake and the Haiti after the earthquake. And Danny, in this novel, sort of afterwards, people, when he would go back, we went back to Haiti after the earthquake, people were saying to him, in a way that I think people, sometimes artists can seem prophetic, people were saying, you knew, didn't you? You knew, you bastard, you didn't tell us. Because he was this funny writer who had written this very serious book. And one of the things that the novelist who returns in the novel, the book writes, says, is what is certain is that I wouldn't have written this if I had stayed there. Maybe I would not have written at all. Living outside of our countries, do we write to console ourselves? So then again, daring to speak when I went on these things for the collective, that's, I grappled to say this, what will we do now? What will people do in the daily, in the living, and how will it be a year from now? But then there is also that thing of people who follow, what will we make of this? Will there be poetry in the ruins of Port-au-Prince and Léogâne and Tigouave and other places that this earthquake hit? 23 days after the earthquake, I got to go on a trip. And it was a last-minute cancellation on a relief plane and begging for friends to stay with my little girls and my husband, who thought he could have handled it, but I thought he needed some backup. And so when I get to Port-au-Prince, it's a very strange thing, and people kept saying it to be like every reference in your life being altered. It's just this incredible feeling. I think it's as if everything you sort of identify with is altered. So the airport is cracked, the windows are broken, but there's this also this strange dynamic. At the time, the U.S. was in charge of the airport. So it was strange, you land there, and there's your, you know, the soldiers, and then outside are customs and borders people. And with my history with the customs and borders and my uncle, it felt strange. And the thing was, one of the sort of disorienting things that if you didn't have, like if you had a Haitian passport, you couldn't get inside the airport. You had to have a U.S. passport. You have to have sort of, you had to be a foreigner to enter the airport. Because part of, I mean, there was a really strong humanitarian effort, but there was also this effort to sort of keep this exodus of people from coming to Miami. There was the sort of a cordoning around the waters of Haiti of Coast Guard to keep people in. And even the Haitian ambassador was asked to broadcast this message saying, stay here, don't go, don't take the seas. And so there was this, I mean, there was sort of the both this type of mission where there was the help with the sort of somewhat militarization, but there was also this thing like, stay here, don't leave. So when I get there, my friend who's a painter meets me with my husband's uncle, who everyone, we sort of, when you meet your loved ones after this, you're sort of looking for signs of how this altered them. With my husband's uncle, it was very easy. Suddenly he was this person who wore a helmet everywhere, like even to bed. He had like and he just wouldn't take it off and because he was trying to avoid falling debris. And then we go on this tour, the thing that everybody who returns gets to, and then you see, as I said, all these places that are identified with your life. You know, the school that I went to as a girl, everything is gone, the art center, where the church, the cathedral, and then these sites of people, women and babies, closing off the street at night to sleep. But the most striking, one of the most striking encounters was when I was going to the general hospital there to meet some family members who were getting care there. And on the way we see there was this nursing and midwifery school that had collapsed with all these young women inside. And this is the thing, too, that we have lost. Like, so it's an instant brain drain. Like, all these students, all these university students, all these schools, most of the people, you hear all these numbers. You know, they say they've extracted so many bodies, but it's safe to say that you probably have an equal number in the rubble. that are not counted. And so when they start moving, as they were starting to do when I was there, when they start moving these blocks, they find body parts. And sometimes they put them on the side of the road. And at that point, there was sort of a pile. It was like this perfectly round thing of arms interlocking. And it seemed as though like dozens of people had been embracing. And I was saying to my friend John, who was a painter who was with me, I said, it just seems as these women had collapsed. And he says, no, they're body parts that have sort of melded together. And because that was new, there were people around praying, asking for forgiveness, sort of beating their chest, mea culpas. People have also, you know, their religiosity, like sort of the spirituality around it, whatever people believe in, they believe in deeper, and they're sort of express it on the street all the time. And so for me, that was one of the most striking things about, you know, just this altered human landscape. And the other part of the altered human landscape was that you had all these people who were amputees walking around. And it seemed very new because they sort of weren't sure what to, you know, it's a very hard landscape to handle. And I always have my brother Kelly, who was born with one arm missing, and we've always tried to seek. There's so much stories around it, you know. And one of the things that my father used to say in Haiti, it's very difficult, you know, about my brother, for people like that. And it was everywhere. There were young people like this, and I kept thinking, you know, I sort of kept thinking about Kelly, and I was trying to process all the positive lore that we say about amputation. And one of them is that if you were born, you know, without you, when you're missing a part of your body, it means that you had a twin in the womb who wanted to mark you so that twin can find you amongst the living. So when you see this, you think of quite a few things. And you think also of naming. And it was very amazing how people tried to name this thing, the earthquake, because we have a lot of names for hurricanes, of course. And we have experience with hurricanes. But earthquakes we don't name. So people would say, bagaila, you know, the thing. Or in my Tonton Jean, the one with the casket, he called it Tiwowo. And I said, well, why, Tonton Jean, do you call it Tiwowo? He said, because when I was in school, there was a boy who bullied me. His name was Tiwowo. So I've named the earthquake after him. And one of the people that a lot of people followed on Twitter was Richard Morse, who is a musician and hotel owner at the Olufsen Hotel in Haiti. And he calls it Samson, like in the Bible. But a lot of people in Haiti also call it Gudugudu. Gudugudu, it's sort of a kind of onomatopoeia, because they say when it's coming, when the earthquake is coming with the aftershocks, it comes with a kind of sound that something is shaking, like Gudugudu. So all this, it's a kind of poetry. Kitli Mars, one of our wonderful contemporary writers, she wrote an essay in which she described it as the devil dancing. So there was poetry in the rubble, as there is poetry often in Haitian language through proverbs, through the way we try to interpret tragedy. But another striking experience I had is that Léogâne is where my family's from in Haiti. And it was really the epicenter, because something like 80 or 90% of Léogâne was destroyed. And when we went back, I went to try to see my grandmother's house, which was an old wooden house, but that they had turned to cement, you know, because there's the dilemma in terms of building, because people had gone from older structures to more cement type structures because they wanted to withstand the hurricanes and the floods. And now, as we rebuild, I think people have to find a middle, something that can withstand both hurricane and floods. But the strange thing in Léogâne to see was that a lot of these old wooden houses did not fall. And a lot of people have also said that they were like trees didn't fall, which is odd, that like they said not one flower fell, which is one of those things that give you pause. But I was going through, when we were going through Léogâne, with my friend John. And when you go through the tent cities, a lot of them have signs and cardboard, sometimes in English, for the Americans or in Spanish or for the Venezuelans and Cubans. And they'll say, "We need food. We're Armenian," on a cardboard. But then in the middle of this big tent city, we saw this gorgeous painting on the tent. And it was of this brown, so this angel with these corpses at her feet and just rising to the heaven. And my friend John just like stopped the car, and he's like, "We got to see this." And then he said, "This is our Guernica." And Guernica, being the Picasso painting that, among other things, supposedly made Jean-Michel Basquiat's mother weep, if you saw that movie, but was the painting that, you know, Picasso painted to bring attention to the German and Italian bombings of the Basque countryside. And he said, Picasso, you said that it's not political, but it's a sign that terrible deaths happened. So John jumps out of this car and he's like, "This is our Guernica. We will have our Guernica." And I had sensed when I was talking to him, you know, that it is true that what Picasso has said, like sometimes art is the most instant depiction of terrible deaths happening, but that ultimately, I think we will not just have one Guernica out of this tragedy, but we will have many, many, through painting, song, many, many. One of the things that Danny Laferrière, back to Danny, said that after, when he left Haiti, you know, and was doing sort of his testimonial of what he had seen, and one of the things he said that, you know, we lost our buildings, but we had cultural structures standing. And the sense of, like, this was the Guernica, that people were painting out of this tent city as best as they can. And these were not people with means, that they were trying to beautify, that this creation was possible, was an extraordinary moment of hope. Back to Maxu, who... where he was buried was the last place I went before I left Haiti. And he was, when he was found under this church that his father had built, and the church, it's very interesting too, like the church, like the leaves, like the trees, and some of the wooden houses, a lot of these statues stand up. I think, you know, after 9/11, they found sort of these incidental crosses. And there is a church in Toujours in Haiti where this cross was, I'm not blessing you all, sorry, where the statue had was just standing there, the crucifix was there, and some of the statues of the heroes of the independence were still standing. And it just seems sort of like a incidental, but patterns in a way, if you have it happen in many places. But my uncle's church was still standing, but everything around it that they had built around this compound had crumbled. And so Maxo's grave was in the bottom, at the bottom of the church where they had a classroom. And when his body was found, like a lot of people, they couldn't take it out because of the conditions of people. They were able to just dig a hole and bury him. But they had glazed some cement over it and written his name and the date of his birth and the date that he died, that he shares with so many people. And it suddenly felt like a privilege to have that opportunity to just be able to go visit this makeshift grave, because so many people didn't have that opportunity. And I had, you know, when I went down there, I had brought with me a book, which Maxo had two favorite books, and one of them was Masters of the Dew by Gouverneur de la Rosée by Jacques Roumain, and another was this book called Les Nègres by Jean Genet. And Les Nègres, he loved sort of this crazy play that, after I'd learned that he died, I got the book and I sort of read the play again. And one of the things that jumped out of me was this quote from it, that your song was very beautiful and your sadness does me honor. I'm going to start life in a new world. If I ever return, I'll tell you what it's like there. Great black country, I bid thee farewell. And so at the grave site, I was thinking about that, and I kept thinking about that as I was leaving, and it eventually became something sort of at the centerpiece of something that I ended up writing about Maxo. But I want to leave you with happier proverbs that nous songer et avancer, as we remember and move forward, and it's things that we say to one another now. N'oubliez mais nous pas tomber. We have stumbled, but we have not fallen. Nous l'aide mais nous là. We are ugly, but we are here. And nous l'aide nous là. Plutôt nous l'aide nous là is one of the things, just like on est respect, that sometimes people say to one another. You say qui j'en est, plutôt nous l'aide nous là. You know, better be ugly, but we are here. And again, nous songer, nous avancer. We remember, but we move forward. And it's going to be such the crucial point in individual lives, in a place, for example, where people now go, you know, people I know go to random funerals when they know people who are privileged enough to have funerals, because it's a way to remember their loved ones that they will not see ever again, that they don't know happened. So, nous songer, nous avancer. We remember, but we move forward. Thank you for this opportunity tonight to do it with you. Thank you. There are some questions. What is the best thing about living in Miami and the worst thing? Worst is underlined. The best thing is, of course, the weather, except in the summer when it is the worst thing. But it's Miami, it's like a community. It's like watching a community in the making, because everyone is, you know, Dave Barry makes all these jokes about Miami where he says that in Miami, everyone is driving, but each is following the rule of his or her country. So it's really like the new community, like being part of a new community. You see it emerge, you see these things, like how different people try to get along. And it's an exciting city in that sense. There's really not, I mean, I don't think there's any bad thing about it, except the weather in July. That's the worst thing about it. What is one of the biggest misconceptions about Haiti? There are so many misconceptions about Haiti, but I think they spring actually from misinformation, because we often get Haitian sound bites. And we've seen, I mean, one of the things that this earthquake has offered, this opportunity for people to learn more about Haiti, to sort of dig deeper. And I think, more than misconceptions, I think there are things that people are not aware of. For example, there's this incredible literature in Haiti that I tried to talk about here a little bit tonight. This wonderful visual art, music, all these other. I mean, I think the biggest misconceptions that we are, you know, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, they said, and maybe that's, you know, sort of even said more now. But we are, I don't want to say the richest country in the Western Hemisphere culturally, but we're one of the richer countries in the world culturally. Can I say that? Do you ever write in French? If not, why not? I don't ever write in French, but it's a long wait. I lived in Haiti the first 12 years of my life, and I had sort of this dichotomy of language. And at home, we spoke Creole. Not all Haitian families, you know, but my family, we spoke Creole at home. And at that time in school, you know, you had to speak French, required. So if we are with our teacher and, you know, with your playing with your kids in the yard and you speak Creole, or if you ask the teacher a question in Creole, she will say, rephrase that, you know, properly. So you had to then write it in French. And I spent a lot of my childhood writing. My parents were in New York, my father when I was 2, my mother when I was 4. And I spent a lot of time writing formulaic letters to my parents in French. To me, that's what it meant, writing in French. Bonjour, maman. Bonjour, papa. Comment ça va? On est bien, grâce à Dieu. So I had that sort of tug of war. When I came here at 12, it was fine. It was the first time, really, that I was writing and living, because I had 2 U.S.-born brothers in the same language, even though we were still speaking Creole at home. So I think it was sort of where creativity and the time. I always say that if we went to Spain, for example, I probably would be writing in Spanish, because it was just how these things met. I never completely trusted my ability to write in French, you know, like proper French, if you will. So that's probably why I don't write in French. But I read in French. A lot of the writers I mentioned, of course, write in French, so I continue to read in French, and I did major in French literature in college, in part because I had this French literature teacher in Haiti who I thought was a goddess, even though she was punishing us for incorrect speaking in school. But I wanted to be her, and I didn't realize. The other day I was psychoanalyzing myself. You know, I said, I majored in college because of somebody who beat me. That's weird. Where do you feel most at home, Haiti or the U.S.? I feel, you know, equally at home in both places. I mean, I've lived in the U.S. now longer than I have lived in Haiti. I mean, in Haiti, there's always the longing of absence. And before I had very small children, it was easy to just, especially from Miami. That's one of the best things about living in Miami, close to Haiti. I would, you know, it was just easy to go. We didn't think much about it. And so, and I felt on some level like I never left Haiti. And one of the things about that in the U.S., especially in a place like Miami, I was often struck when I first started traveling around the U.S., I mean, how diverse the landscape is, the people are sort of this whole diversity. So I feel equally comfortable. Like if I suddenly went to live somewhere else, Haiti or anywhere else, I think I would very much miss the U.S. Do I have any upcoming film projects? No. I had briefly, I used to work for a production company. I used to work for Jonathan Demme. And he, you know, that experience contributed a great deal to my life in the sense that we went to Haiti a lot with him. I went to Haiti with him at a time where my parents used to discourage it a lot, but I would say, "Oh, it's for my work." so he sort of, it's funny, sort of like you get a guide, someone who's not from a place to go back with you, and it's going sort of a different access because, you know, when we would go, we'd film like the president and things like that, and then I would go see my uncle, and so it was the, like seeing the society on all these different levels. No film projects. Okay, this one is very. What do you say to the Iraqi cleric who said loose women cause earthquakes? I say shut up. Is my first name a common name in Haiti? which is linked to this other question: why are you called Edwige when your brothers are called Bob, Carl, and Kelly? Why, mother, why? Well, there was a French actress at the time that my mother was pregnant called Edwige Ferrière. And I understand that my parents went to one of the few movies they had in Haiti at that time. And that's what they decided to name me after her. And then they became American and named my brothers these other names. But actually my brother, who we call Bob, his name is Eliab. And Eliab, it's from the Bible somewhere. And his name is Bob because one of my parents wanted to call him Robert, Robert. So he's called Bob. Again, thank you very, very much.
That was Edwige Dantakot. She spoke in Portland in 2010 in the Portland Arts and Lecture Series. Dantakot is a Haitian-American author of award-winning books such as Breath, Eyes, Memory, and Brother, I'm Dying, and is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. Dantakot was our featured author this time for Literary Arts, The Archive Project. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thank you for joining us.